We're back at Microsoft Research again. It's been about 4 or 5 months, and boy, it's been a busy time. We've been doing all sorts of crazy stuff. We just opened up a lab, a very small lab in India last week, and that was very exciting. And
where are we, first of all?
We're in Microsoft Research Redmond, Building 112. We're actually on the floor with the graphics group, and they're all incredibly busy right now. Matt will be getting papers together for the paper submission deadline for SIGGRAPH. So we're going to go bug them first for a couple minutes. And there's some other folks we can go bug. So
cool.
Let's go on down the hall and
let's go
meet them. All right. So, yeah, it's just super energetic time to be in Microsoft Research as always. There's just so much cool stuff going on. We have this big thing going on, which is every March we have this thing called TechFest, which is a big internal trade show that we do where we show off demos to the rest of the company about all the cool stuff we're doing. And people who aren't working on paper submission deadlines are madly working on their TechFest deadlines. So everybody in Microsoft Research is super hard at work on cool stuff.
Now, one of my friends on a blog last night, Hugh McLeod, said, why doesn't Microsoft build the tricorder? And I said the last time I was here, I saw something that looked like the holodeck under development, right? with the monitor technology.
Actually, I think we'd prioritize the transporter above that.
Ah, really?
I'll spend part of my time flying to conferences. I think we'd much rather have a transporter.
I don't want to beta test that. I'm not signing up for the beta test. Anyways, introduce us to the first group here.
So the guy in the corner over here is Turner Whitted, who's one of the pioneers and brightest minds in graphics and computing. And with him, you want to introduce the folks that are here?
Sure. Since we're in the middle of a meeting, come on in. This is Hughes Hopkins.
That's what I do. It's interrupt meetings.
That's fine of us.
It's the new transparency.
Hughes Hoppe is one of our senior researchers here in the MSR graphics group, and Sylvain Lefebvre is our brand new, just arrived postdoc in the MSR graphics group. So this is something we're trying to explain to him. Happens every day, and he should just carry on as if nothing happened. This is just part of our normal everyday operation. We're all sitting here. These guys are rushing to finish up their SIGGRAPH submission. This happens every year at graphics research labs all over the world, where people are just running down to the wire trying to finish their not just finish the publication, but finish the actual experiments that go into it. And hopefully the publication and the experiments will all come together on the night before the papers are due.
Can you give us a little sneak peek what you guys are researching? No?
Well,
okay.
Well, as you probably, I mean, you've seen.
Is this top secret Longhorn stuff? Or?
I don't think anything about Longhorn is top secret, but this stuff is brand new. We have a lot of effort going on in the area of geometry, geometric modeling, texture synthesis. Sylvain's dissertation is about texture synthesis. He's an expert on that. It's something that we have some interest in. You can talk to Hughes about the geometric modeling work that he's been doing, because that's some of the leading work in all of graphics research.
Okay.
Or I could talk about your research, because I love it.
if my mom was here, how would you explain what you're researching?
Say geometry images or something like that.
We're trying to create images from little amounts of data. We're trying to amplify small amounts of data to get a lot of expansion for free, basically. So a lot of platforms like Xbox are very limited as far as memory.
Yep.
So we'd like to be able to create lots and lots of content almost for free, both procedurally and then by looking at real data. So imagine taking a picture of a piece of texture, like a piece of cloth, and then being able to generate more and more of it on the fly. That's what we'd like to do.
Sounds neat.
And the same thing with Hugh's previous work on terrain, where he can compress terrain into tiny data sets, but when he expands it has all the detail that you'd expect. It's really addictive to dive into detailed terrain to see just how much detail there is. And I find myself staying away from his demos, because once I sit down at them, I'm there for an hour or so.
Tell me about it. Has any of your previous work been put into products that we all use, or have you done a key part of Halo 2 or anything?
That's not true. Yes, we have a fairly good record of that. I mean, if you look at Hughes, has had a you can explain better than I what
progressive meshes work, for instance. That was something about 8 years ago now. So the idea of being able to simplify very complicated geometric models, and that's used in games quite a bit. So people can now author very intricate models with lots of detail. And then after you've authored it, you can simplify it down to many fewer triangles so that it renders much more quickly. Right. So that's a pretty common tool.
We actually have a fairly good record of transferring technology from graphics into, I'll give you one example for them, is ClearType, which was an interdisciplinary effort that involved the graphics group and involved about every other group you can look at. And since it's one I worked on personally, one of my favorites. But if I go into the store and if I drag my son in there and say, here, I want to show you something that, you know, he's not terribly impressed. But if you take the sum total of all of those research results and see what their impact is on products, especially in the gaming area for this group, then it starts to add up. And I'm pretty impressed with what these guys have done.
So your work might be showing up in Halo 4 or Halo 5 or something like that.
Well, the field as a whole has been pretty impressed with the work that these folks have done. In fact, you know, he's being very modest sitting right here, but last year at SIGGRAPH, he won the Lifetime Achievement Award for the work that he'd done and the contributions he's made for the field. So, you know, he really is one of the stars of the field, even though, you know, he won't say it himself. I'm more than happy to.
What were you recognized for? What was the big idea that caught everybody's attention?
This representation of geometry in a multi-resolution setting,
okay.
Being able to switch resolutions very quickly, being able to morph between different complexities of models. So, and then also perhaps parametrization work, being able to texture models, so combining geometric descriptions and then image representations on top of the geometry.
Right.
Guys, thanks for your time.
It's an honor meeting you.
Get back to work on the papers.
Yep. Good luck.
Thanks. All right. Okay, we are actually going to jump over to our other building, to 113.
Okay.
As I mentioned, Hughes and the work that he's done, and the Lifetime Achievement Award at SIGGRAPH. One of the things that we sort of like to have bragging rights about is we still kind of feel like we're a young lab. You know, we're 13 years old now, but, you know, in terms of, like, computer science departments, computer science labs, that's still pretty young. Hughes was sort of a breakthrough moment for us because he was really the first time, you know, he was recognized for, you know, a Lifetime Achievement Award. We've had Turing Award winners and other folks like that in the lab, but he was really the first one who got an award like that, and essentially all of his work has been done here at Microsoft Research.
Wow.
Yeah, so you know, it's a case where somebody came here, and you know the work that they did here, as you know, the sum total of the course of a very significant period of time, you know, was really sort of recognized by the field for just being really seminal important work.
Where are we going next?
So let's go on. We're going to go downstairs so we can probably
put this on pause.
So, hey, we're back. So this is Jim Lurris, and he is one of our senior researchers in. Looking at source code analysis and software developer tools and all that kind of stuff. So,
get over here. Okay. It's a little bit better. So, what do you do?
So,
you can sit.
Yeah. Let's get comfortable.
Yeah. I have a couple of research groups that look at building tools for finding bugs in software. So, we've built a number of tools over the years. Probably the most successful of them is the SLAM tool, which is now being productized by Windows as the static driver verifier. And it's
What is that? What for an end user, where will they see the? Yeah, will they see better quality? Will they see
so we've,
better performance?
No. We're just in finding bugs in the code.
Okay.
So we started with the idea that if the programmers told us a little more about what their code was supposed to do, we would take their code and we'd take this description of what the code was supposed to do in the form of these rules, and we would feed them to a tool and we'd say, tell us if the program is following the rules that they're supposed to or not.
Right.
And so with SLAM, we built a tool that knew about orderings, temporal orderings of things. So, you know, when you open a file, you got to call the file open call first before you do anything, and then you can read and write the file. And eventually, you better close it. And once you've closed it, you better not do anything else to that file descriptor. So interfaces have rules like this all over the place. And they weren't really written down, and there was no good way of checking them. So with SLAM, what we did is we looked at one of the sort of worst areas for this type of rule, which is writing device drivers for the Windows kernel. You know, you go and start to write a device driver, you go out and get this 1,000-page book. It's full of lots of these rules that basically says, you know, in this situation, you've got to do this, and don't forget to do that. And if you ever do this, everything's just going to fall apart. The kernel's just going to go away, and you're going to blue screen. And it's really hard, even for people who've been doing it for a long time, to take all these rules and remember them and get them right on every path through their code.
What does SLAM stand for again?
I don't even remember what it stands for anymore. It's lost in the midst of time.
And is there a name for this new type of methodology?
Yeah.
I know, like, people have talked about test-driven development.
Yeah, well, the technique that we developed in the group is called counterexample-driven abstraction refinement.
Wow, that's a mouthful.
Yeah,
call it SLAM.
Yeah.
That's what I call it, SLAM. But, you know, it is an entirely new technique that a couple of people in the group came up with. It's had tremendous impact on the research community. It's gotten people really excited in the research community because it's a new way of looking at code and analyzing code to find errors in it. With Inside Microsoft, we've actually been very lucky because we found a group in Windows that was concerned with driver quality. And we had built this prototype tool to find bugs in drivers, and they said, oh, this is great. This is the way we're going to do quality. So we worked with them for about 2 years to take the research prototype and turn it into something that Windows is now demoed at driver conferences and is on track to ship sometime, I believe, this year.
Can you show us what the tool looks like?
Actually, I was just looking for a copy, and all, you know, since it's been developed in Windows, we don't even have a recent version over here.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, what we had is about a year old, and I don't even think it runs anymore.
Okay.
So, you know, but a lot of what happened is, you know, we had the core engine, and we didn't know that much about device drivers. So we worked with Windows and turned, you know, something basically a research piece of software into a commercial quality piece of code and built up a library of hundreds of rules.
Okay.
So, you know, you run it on device drivers and it basically says, you know, in this path for the code, you forgot to do this. And it tells you exactly what it is you got wrong. And it tells you what path for the code. And we've been running it on drivers inside Microsoft and have found lots of errors in our drivers. And we've demoed it at driver conferences where we set up a booth and have third-party vendors come up with a, you know, a CD or, you know, a memory stick with their driver on it. And they, you know, say, oh, you know, you're not going to find anything. This is, you know, driver we've had for a long time. And we run it, and we give them back a couple error messages, and they're just, like, totally blown away that, you know, this tool can find these difficult errors.
Yeah.
And, you know, given the difficulty of debugging drivers in the kernel, things like this really can make a huge difference.
Absolutely.
There's really sort of a philosophical change that happened. If you think back, you know, it was the 80s and 90s. There's a lot of people who talked about source code analysis. And unfortunately, as a field, we did ourselves a disservice by always looking at sort of the perfect model. And we'd say, oh, the halting problem says we analyze and know what a piece of software is going to do. And what these guys did was they said, look, let's not try to get it perfect. And in fact, Butler Lampson has an interesting way of sort of describing. Butler Lampson is one of the Turing Award winners. He's also a professor at MIT and generally incredibly smart guy. And he says, you know, the field as a whole talks about grand challenges. You know, what are the big computer science problems that we should try to solve? And his favorite one is using computers and software to reduce traffic fatalities to zero. And that is a nice problem because we will probably never make it perfectly to zero.
Yep.
But every improvement we do that reduces it is a great, wonderful thing. I think of sort of software analysis in the same way. Will we ever find every single bug and perfectly understand what this piece of software did? No. But you know what? Every chip off that, every little bit more that we understand it, and every algorithm we can create that finds one more bug before it gets out of customers' hands, just makes things better.
Yeah.
Right? And Jim and Jim's team have really embraced that, and it's fundamentally changed the way we look at software analysis inside the company, and it's fundamentally changing the field as a whole in the way that they look at it.
How does the piece of software learn from new rules? That, you know, because it sounds like you're just studying cracked patterns, right?
They are patterns, but, you know, they're the patterns that are designed in there by the person who wrote the software in the first place. And a lot of times, you know, the person doesn't even understand them. I mean, we can tell you stories about how when we were doing this driver verifier, we'd have a couple of people from Windows who knew device drivers in and out, sitting in a conference room on a whiteboard, drawing diagrams on the board, arguing about where the arcs are supposed to go. You know, is this rule supposed to go this way or that way? And, you know, they're going to have to go look at the kernel code to figure out what the answer is. And these are experts.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that you get from writing these rules down is that there's no ambiguity anymore. You know, the person who wrote the software writes down the rules, they say what they mean, and the people who use the software get to get an unambiguous version. It's not English prose anymore. It's a real clear specification. And that's a huge step forward in and of itself. Can you imagine if, you know, our interfaces all came with these really concise descriptions to say, this is the way you use it correctly. It doesn't tell you everything, because as Kevin said, you know, we're not trying to make software perfect. We're trying to find the low-hanging fruit, get the bugs that are really common, the ones that bite people most of the time. So you imagine our software came with this kind of interface and basically said, you know, this is the way it's supposed to work, and you can read it, and you can feed it to your favorite tool, and the tool can also analyze your software and use the same specification to drive the bug checking process. I think that would be a huge step forward. And, you know, the other thing I think that would happen, which would be great, is if people who wrote the interfaces had to write the rules, they would be forced to write a lot simpler interfaces.
Yep.
Because, you know, when you start having state machines that have, you know, 50 states and a couple hundred transistors in it, you got to think, this is too complicated. Maybe I should start again and think this over again. And that would be a big step forward in and of itself.
Interesting. So why does a tool like this come from research and not from the product team? What's different about research versus the product
team? Well, you know, the thing is, we actually have had tools that have found bugs that have come from within an internal tools group that are widely used inside Microsoft. And those tools differed in one major way. The tools that we build are what is called sound, which means that when you're looking for a particular error in the code, our tools will find it. I mean, they may find a lot of other errors. They have noise. There's a lot of false positives in it. But they guarantee that if you're looking for a particular error, you know, if you have that file descriptor specification and you're looking for file open errors and there's one in your code, we're going to find it.
Right.
The tools that have been out there before, what other people have done, are heuristic, and they don't make any kind of guarantees. And that's a big deal, right? Because, you know, when you get down to that last bug, you know, and you get rid of it, does it mean that you've gotten rid of the last bug in your code, or you've just gotten rid of the last bug that the tool can find? And there's a big difference between the two. Our tools, when you get down to that, you know, zero bugs, you know that you've gotten rid of the last instance of that bug, and you don't have to worry about it anymore. And so that's where the research came in, is basically to develop the techniques to make sound analysis practical for pretty big, very complicated pieces of code. And, you know, it's been interesting. We've pioneered a bunch of research areas. We've gotten the community interested, the research community interested in it. There are a lot of great tools that are coming out of universities these days because of the students we've worked with or the ideas that we've worked on. And so it's really great for everybody to see this kind of development because, you know, there's plenty of bugs out there.
Yep.
And there's a lot of opportunity to find them.
Now, it sounds like you worked on this tool a year ago. So what are the big problems you're working on solving today? Can you share any of that?
Yeah, sure. We're actually still doing a lot of the same type of things, though we're looking beyond the simple temporal properties. We're now looking at more complicated properties that involve values in the programs, not just the sequence of operations in the programs. And we're also really interested in concurrency. I think that that's the big challenge, because for a lot of reasons, concurrency is just harder for people. It turns out that you can also show formally that concurrency is just harder for tools to analyze. Fundamentally different.
And we just talked to the Visual C++ team about that last week.
Right, they're very concerned about this. And, you know, concurrency is coming, right? Intel.
Sorry for losing battery there.
That's fine.
Yeah, so we're talking about concurrency.
Yeah, it's talking about concurrency. So, you know, concurrency is in everybody's future, right? I mean, you know, Intel and AMD have already said they're going to be bringing out these chip multiprocessors, and it's going to become cheaper and cheaper to get multiprocessors that'll just sit on your desk and be around. And so everybody's going to have to deal with it if you're going to want to take advantage of these machines and run fast.
Yeah.
And the problem is that, you know, even experts, even the sort of really good programmers who've been doing it for a long time make a lot of mistakes with concurrency.
Yeah.
And so
one of the nice things about your approach, though, with sort of defining these sets of rules, is you could define a set of rules for how to write concurrent programs that aren't actually necessarily, you know, integrated deeply in any set of interfaces. It's just, you know, a set of rules to follow in how you design and develop the program.
That's right. You can certainly define a set of rules. I mean, they range from fairly simple rules that we could check quite easily now, things like locking protocols. You know, if you acquire a lock on this path, you better release it at some point along this path. I mean, that doesn't even depend on knowing that the program is concurrent. It's just, you know, one of these temporal operations on locks. But then when you start getting looking at the program as a whole with the multiple threads, then it starts actually getting really challenging, Kevin, to talk about what the rules are. You know, that's one of the problems with what we have today is that locks and threads are a very low-level mechanism. It's basically like writing assembly code and using go-tos to develop your program. And so a lot of what we're doing now is thinking about what's a better high-level programming model. You know, is there a better way for the programmer to write down concisely what they really would like to do? And we'll worry a little bit more about the implementation. Just like, you know, in a programming language, you don't just get go-tos. You get control constructs like if statements and while statements and procedure calls. And that makes programming a lot simpler, even though you're a little bit removed from the direct hardware. And I think for a lot of people, that would be a really good trade-off for concurrency as well.
What did you do before you came to Microsoft?
Well, I was a professor, actually, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison for 8 years. And then I came to Microsoft Research for 1 year on sabbatical. And that was 7 years ago. So, you know, I thought it was a great place. I mean, it seemed like an incredible opportunity to work with people here who were doing amazing things. I mean, things that I just hadn't seen anybody in universities do, and to get the kind of sustained support that Microsoft Research had, it just seemed unbelievable. And you know, I had come to Microsoft Research to sort of see how the real world develops software. And I was kind of shocked.
And you're still looking for that, aren't you?
I was actually really surprised to see that, you know, Microsoft, which at the time I think was the biggest software company in the world, was using pretty much the same tools as everybody else was. And, you know, there was a huge opportunity there. I was sure that we could do better. And so for the last 7 years, I've been trying to do better. And I feel like, you know, we've made some progress. We've scratched the surface. There's a long, long way to go. But, yeah, that's a great situation to be in from the researcher's point of view. It's that there are a lot of challenges. There are a lot of good things we can do. There's a lot, you know, we're getting a lot of tech transfer into the product groups with the tools that have come out of my group. And so, you know, the rest of the world is actually going to see some of this stuff, I think, pretty soon. We're really psyched about that.
If you were going to show somebody around Microsoft Research, what would you show them? Especially like another professor or something.
Well, you know.
What would be your
I have to say. Our stuff doesn't demo as nearly as well as the graphics people. I've been jealous about graphics people for my entire career.
Because, you know, we just saw them, but they wouldn't demo for us.
they're always using their graph people.
That's too bad, because, you know, I always thought, you know, I'd love to be able to do something I could show my mother, and she would actually be impressed. Because, you know, showing her a tool that finds bugs or a compiler just doesn't make it. So, you know, I think there are a lot of really cool things that have been done in terms of user interfaces. I mean, if a professor comes here, almost any professor is going to find somebody at Microsoft Research doing something that's of interest to them, near to them. You know, in fact, what's a lot of my colleagues who come to like our summer meetings for faculty have been most impressed by the kind of things we're doing, which have immediate tech transfer into the real world. Remember last summer, one of them was just pulled over by the talk on the image processing photos for digital photos, and all the tools that Microsoft Research has built that are now getting into our products there. Because, you know, he has a digital camera, and it's like, you know, wow, I didn't know I could do that. So, and, you know, I think professors are just like everybody else. They like the stuff that they can look at and see and say, hey, I could use that.
There's some pretty big brains around here, right? Let's just be honest. Who do you look up to in the hallway? Who would you? Who do you always go, oh my God, I just met him?
Well, you know, when I first came here, I was just amazed at the sort of famous computer scientists that hung around Microsoft Research. You know, there's people like Jim Gray and Gordon Bell.
I'm interviewing them in February.
And you know, Leslie Lamput down in Silicon Valley, and you know, these guys are just, you know, famous for a very long career of very, very successful research that's had huge impact. And the fact that, you know, they're working here and you can, you know, call them up, send them email, talk to them, it took me years to get over that, that they're now my colleagues here at Microsoft. And, you know, it's great to be able to talk to people like this because they have a wealth of experience. You know, Butler's a great person. We're doing a systems project, and it's really good to have Butler come in and give us his perspective.
Who's Butler?
Butler Lampson, the guy at, you know, he was the guy at Xerox who did a lot of the original work on Xerox
you know, hardware and software systems. The, you know, the basically the beginning of the personal computer. He was the guy behind it and made it all work. And just a whole bunch of other systems after that. And, you know, he's seen it. He's got a huge amount of experience, got really good judgment about what works, what makes sense, what doesn't. And to have that person like that around is fabulous.
Well, we should probably let you go.
Great.
Okay. Good.
Thanks.
Sir, good. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was awesome. It's fun to meet you. Thanks.
Nice.